This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, February 8, 2013. I'm Caleb Brown. Gone are the days of football players assuming all of the risks of their own choices to play a high-impact contact sport. Today, football is the subject of a growing body of litigation surrounding brain injury. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, comments. Years ago, I read a headline in the Louisville Courier-Journal, which, of course, at one time was a large boxing venue, and the headline was basically, "The risk of brain injury keeps boxing controversial." And I thought the same thing as with litigation related to brain injury in football, which is, well, look, once you get over the fact that these are people beating each other up to entertain a large number of people, it shouldn't be too controversial that there are risks associated with beating people up. And football, it seems like a prime example of that.
I think legally, boxing and football are going to be seen in two different lights. With boxing, the whole point of the game is to aim blows at the other guy's head. And with football, it will be argued, and I suspect with some success, that you knew it was rough on the muscles and the joints. You knew that there were a lot of physical risks, but the players were not told how serious the risk of brain damage was and might not have made the same decisions if they had been told.
Okay, so what are we seeing right now with respect to what we know, what we should have known, what players should have been told about brain injury and the scope of litigation here?
Well, we know that more than 4,000 veteran players are now being represented in claims for compensation. That's a lot. And that means that there is likely to be litigation for years to come. The litigation names not only the most obvious deep pocket leak, but also, for example, helmet maker. And to the extent that the cases become successful, you can expect that they will name various other defendants. I predict in particular that those involved in training and in sports medicine are going to be pulled in. From the standpoint of the lawyers pressing these cases, they are after indications that the owners knew that it was more dangerous than they were letting on. They're also going to be looking for things like team doctors who sent players out even though there were still some lingering signs of concussions. Now, if you remember the asbestos litigation, more than thousands and thousands of companies sued, but one of the things that got juries in a punitive damages mood was the revelation that at some employers, workers would be examined. They would be told, oh, well, you know, you're coughing. Everyone coughs. I'll go back to work. And weren't told that it was an occupational related cough. And they're going to be looking for those sorts of things. I'm sure that some doctors will be shown to have behaved well, and probably others not so well.
Well, what should be the understanding within the law from Walter Olson's perspective in terms of getting back to a situation where people are largely charged with making their own determinations about their own risks?
Their own determinations. And historically, there was a very powerful principle of assumption of risk, which unless you were really defrauded in some way, unless someone said, look, here is a meadow to gamble over and there was a cliff there instead and you fell down the Alps. Unless you were being really badly defrauded in your information about the thing, the law gave you the right to take very substantial risks, including grave physical risks. And that has been a principle the law has been much more dubious about the last 50 years. That from the law schools came an absolute charge saying, oh, assumption of risk is terrible. It stands in the way of social insurance through litigation. People don't really decide on these things. They're just led to do whatever the boss asks them. Assumption of risk is just a fiction. Now, the courts have not done away with it, but they have chipped it away to the point where lots and lots of lawsuits, and we remember the tobacco litigation, and we remember the attempts at least to sue over fast food and things like that. And I think it's a fair statement that the vitality of assumption of risk as a defense varies a great deal from state to state and court to court and situation to situation. And getting back to football for a moment, the lawyers are not all going to have to sue in a particular court, let's say where the home team played. They're going to have a choice of a lot of different courts, and lawyers are extremely good at finding the more liberal ones where the precedent is on their side on questions like assumption of risk.
Are we getting to a point, and maybe you can speak to this in other kinds of litigation, where the claim is not necessarily what you knew, but what you should have known?
Oh, definitely. The argument will be, in the first place, if someone in organized football was onto this, that you were a member of the league and you know, this either was or should have been spread among you, that if you had done a little bit of research, you would have known. And so you were willfully blind. These arguments come very naturally to lawyers. And so you don't have to find a memo in which someone clearly was aware. You just have to show that with a little digging, they could have been on top of this issue earlier than they were. Let me say a bit more about additional defendants, because professional football is fed by college and ultimately by high school football. And as defendants, those may be particularly vulnerable. In the first place, whatever the rules for players above the age of majority, if you are talking about putting kids out there who haven't reached legal age of majority yet, you're going to come under a much more hostile legal regime. And the exposure, although here and there is sovereign immunity that will keep government educational institutions from being sued, these are not places that want to court litigation against their very own constituency students. They are likely to cut and run if there is a significant chance of getting bogged down in litigation.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at cato.org.